Yo, welcome back to the Uproar Podcast. Today's guest, Nathan Phillips, is from one of the biggest independent metal labels in the world, Nuclear Blast. They have bands such as Hatebreed, In Flames, Slayer. He also does A&R at Sharptone with breakthrough bands such as Caskets, Hold and Absence and Loathe. We get into how record labels work, how A&R works, and some of his personal achievements. So let's get into it.
I think the thing to start with then is, what actually is A&R?
Wow. Yeah, I guess A&R means different things to different people, especially these days. My approach is a little more old school. You know, for me, there is a real mixture of scouting, artist development, working on deals that we think are going to be profitable for the future. And I try to kind of mix the perfect blend for an A&R really is to mix that blend of artist development and scouting with, quite frankly, business development, both on the artist side and on the company side. I mean, you know, most companies or labels within A&R department, they're looking for something that ultimately you want to take at point A and grow to point B, C, D, and so on. But yeah, but for me, it's identifying talent, whether that's new talent, existing talent, and bringing it into the company and putting a plan and a structure around it in which it can grow and in which it can develop and ultimately, hopefully, make money for the band and for the label in tandem as things go forward.
Awesome. I mean, how much of when you're looking to sign a band, is it that the label's got an idea of what it's looking for and you're searching for that? And how much is it just that you're just like, fuck, this band is sick?
Yeah.
I'm going to break them.
The perfect scenario is when it's both. But there are, you know, there's definitely kind of criteria, and every label's different in terms of kind of what they're looking for and, you know, the size of things they're looking for, the things they're looking to invest in. But for me, it always starts with the artist themselves. I want to understand what their vision is for their art. And ultimately, you know, my job and the label I work for, it's our job to help them amplify that art and ultimately commercialize it. And so it's just trying to kind of get to like a common state of mind, I guess, with the artists themselves, the artist team sometimes. But yeah, I think right now, I mean, I'm kind of, there are some specific things that I'm kind of looking into and that we're investigating that we think could be, you know, kind of interesting trends for the future. But honestly, I'm also taking some bets on some things that I just think are great. And that honestly, I kind of believe that even though these things are unknowns, you know, kind of right now, my ambition and plan is for them, you know, to be very, very well known in the next few years. Yeah. But that comes down to, you know, those individuals, their talent, their drive, their passion for what they do. And all of that stuff is just super, super important to me. There's a lot of people out there making music. There's a lot of bands out there now, more than there ever has been, probably at any point in time. So it's difficult to kind of find what we call the real ones. But yeah, I think it's an exciting time as well. There's lots of different kind of genre mashes at the moment. Lots of people trying different things. There's a lot of really great aesthetic out there, and we're seeing a lot of people put a lot of time into their kind of visuals and you know, kind of how they look and how they present themselves. I kind of wish those, some of those people would put a bit more time into their songwriting as well. Yeah. But yeah, it can be like a real kind of mixed bag in terms of what we're looking for.
I mean, when you're looking at signing a band, if it's like a completely fresh new band, what are the sort of things that you're looking at other than just the songs are good? Like, are you looking at the team around them? Like, or if they don't have a team, does that have any impact? Like, are you looking for someone with a manager or not with a manager or with an agent? Like, are there things like that you take into consideration? And if, for instance, there was a great band, but they had a shit manager, would that like put you off? Like,
that happens. That's a really good question. And to be honest, it is a consideration. And the reason it's a consideration is because if you bring an artist in at a super early level and they don't have a team around them, part of your responsibility really is to help them find the right team. I always think it's, you know, my responsibility. And to be honest, I've done that recently with some totally brand new artists that we've released on Sharptone and on Nuclear Blast. And so in those situations, you need to be in a situation where you're really sure that you want to work with this artist, because honestly, taking bands on at a really young or a really early stage is so much work. And it's fine. I mean, I love putting the work in, but you need to be realistic about how much of that, in terms of capacity, that's kind of taking up.
Yeah.
it really does take time to kind of find the right people, to kind of build the band around, you know, that kind of seeding them with different parts of the scene and different parts of the industry. And it can take a long time. And that's one of the conversations I always have with artists that are starting out. It's like, this will take time. Unless you're very lucky, it's not going to be that kind of stratospheric rise to, you know, to where everything's just hype in the first 12 months. And to be honest, I don't like it when that happens anyway. I much prefer to kind of just slowly build, you know, really steadily over time. I've seen that happen with bands that have just got all the hype and then the following year it's gone and it's really hard to...
I might be wrong, but you tend to see like the longer it takes them to get to the top, the longer it takes them to come back down.
Yeah.
The faster they get up there, the faster they come back down. So you want to build the longevity, I guess. And
yeah, no, absolutely. It's really important. And also it's really important that the band has the right team around them. You know, ultimately, unless the band are, you know, very well versed in how the industry works, I would always recommend that they take on management at some point, but at a point that's right for them. I'm not forcing it upon anybody at all. And of course, yeah, having an agent that understands what the live vision is and you know, where to build it and in which markets, and you know, that's super important too. So it's a really, the ecosystem of how everything kind of fits together is really important. But yeah, when you take those bands on at an early stage and they don't have that set up, it does take time and it's a lot of work. So you really have to think carefully about, like, do I have the time? Is this band worth it? And that comes with all of those conversations you have to have, like, super super early on. And it can be a little bit frustrating for bands sometimes, I think, when especially new bands that kind of come in. And if I'm speaking to them about, you know, potentially working together in the future, I need to find out as much as I can about that band before we make a commitment.
Yeah, of course.
So it takes a bit of time. There's a bit of like a, it's like dating, I guess. It's you know, where you're kind of like, is this, do I
want each other?
Yeah, do I, is this a relationship I want to kind of, you know, like push out and develop and whatever. And sometimes the answer is no, you know, from the band side or from our side. So, you know, we could talk to bands for, you know, a few months or whatever, and nothing might come of it. But I think that's important because it just, you know, it's really important who you work with, I think, in this industry, and making sure that those choices are right for you. So.
Does it make a big difference if there's a member or members of the band that do have a lot of, like, sort of business acumen? It's not just pure musical passion. Like, if you meet them and they actually do have an idea of what's going on and they've got a handle on what they need to spend or what they need to not spend and stuff like that, does that influence wanting to work with
them? It can help, you know, for sure. But it's just about, you know, for me, the potential will always override all of that, because I think, you know, there's not really much you can do in terms of, like, teaching somebody talent, or, like, you know, kind of giving someone the potential. It just is kind of, it's either there or it's not. But the rest of the stuff you can either learn, you know, that stuff, or if you don't want to learn it, there is always somebody else around that can fill the gaps or kind of bring that knowledge to the table. So, you know, it's nice when you're kind of speaking with artists or with bands or whatever that do have an understanding of how things work. It's more just like there are less conversations that you need to have before they're like, oh yeah, I understand why we're doing this. Yeah. So yeah, so it's not, you know, it's not the be all and end all, but I think, you know, it's probably in a band's best interest, to be honest, to inform themselves. And, you know, there's a lot of knowledge out there. There's a lot of, you know, kind of learning to be had, either from, you know, people in the industry or, like, you know, other people that have kind of been there and done it, you can get some good feedback from, or, you know, get some examples of what's worked for them, what hasn't worked for them. But yeah, you know, definitely educate yourself and inform yourself so that you understand why certain things are happening in a certain way, or why decisions have been made in a certain way, or, you know, whatever. It just helps you to understand and feel a bit more comfortable with that.
So when you are signing a band, once you've got to the point where you're like, we are going to sign them, what sort of is the process then? How do you decide what the terms are, like what the advances are, if there are advances, like how the option periods you're putting in, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it kind of gets technical. You know, this is the side of the job that honestly people don't really see. The way I think about A&R really is like a pyramid. So you've kind of got this, you know, kind of pyramid shape, and right at the top of the pyramid, that very kind of snow cap at the top, that's the scouting, and that's the kind of finding the band. And then everything else that's kind of beneath that is the thing that's supporting that kind of scouting process. And within that comes, yeah, the whole term of, like, you know, building a deal, understanding what the potential is for that particular artist. From me, essentially, I need to make a projection, and you need to, I spend probably half my life buried in spreadsheets, putting together, you know, budgets and P&L projections based on what I kind of think that artist could achieve over a certain period. And it could be some, you know, over the next 7 years or over the next 10 years or, you know, whatever. And all of my projections and finances and everything else will be built into that spreadsheet to give us an idea of what we can expect. So if I'm speaking to an artist or I'm speaking to a manager that's looking for certain terms, they might be looking for like a 10-year license. They might be looking for a specific royalty rate. They might be looking for specific advances. I'll plug all of that in into a, essentially into a projection spreadsheet. And then I need to match that against what I think the revenue potential of that band could be. And sometimes it makes sense and sometimes it makes no sense at all, which is when you need to go back to a manager or a band and say, guys, you know, like, this is unrealistic, or actually there's a deal here that we could work out, and, you know, this is what it would look like. So it's very much kind of based on expectation of the artist in terms of kind of what they need. Because ultimately we want to create an environment in which a band can create the record that they want to create, and that we can put enough kind of marketing spend and support behind that record when it comes out so that it reaches the audience it needs to reach. And of course there's a cost to that, and someone has to pay it somewhere along the line. But ultimately what we're trying to do is create deals in which we both benefit. You know, that's always the way that we would approach it. So it's a real kind of massaging exercise where you're trying to, you know, taking a number from here, an expectation from there, a request from management or, you know, whatever, and you're trying to kind of massage all of these kind of data points into a deal or an offer that actually is going to work, that you think might work for the future. And of course, sometimes these projections are right. Sometimes you exceed expectations, and sometimes they're wrong, and in which case you don't make the money. So it's difficult sometimes, but that's really the next stage is understanding what the band needs and then trying to put together an offer that makes sense for them and that also makes sense for us.
When you're putting together the offers, is there with the advances like a typical growth in it? So say there's three option periods, and each one has an advance. Is there just like a standard thing where you go, okay, option one is this, we're going to double it for this one? Or is that completely different every time?
Yeah, it can be different. And actually what it tends to be different depending on where a band's at in their career. And also it depends what the band wants. Some bands that we work with, actually they would prefer regular cash flow. So what they do in that case is that advances are what they say, they're advances on the band's royalties.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you want more of that royalty up front and you want a higher advance, you know, that's fine. But sometimes you might get into like year 3, year 4 of the deal, and actually because you took a big advance a few years ago, there's no money coming in because you're still paying that advance off. And so some bands actually are super smart with that, and they're like, actually I only need X amount to get this record made. It's a smaller advance than we might, you know, typically ask for. But I actually have a lot of respect for those artists that request that, because what they're doing is they're forward planning.
Yeah.
And they're like, actually in year 3, when we want to be on tour in Japan or Australia, like we want to make sure that like every couple of, you know, at least twice a year, there's a royalty check coming in, and we've got some cash flow coming in. So yeah. So it's kind of, I love it when bands are realistic, to be honest, when bands are just like, we want to make a record, you know, we want to work with this producer, we want to be in this studio, this is the budget, you know, we want to create some artwork, this is the budget, we want to do some new photos, this is the budget, do some videos, cool, this is, but they're not trying to like blow the budgets out.
Yeah.
They're just trying to be realistic. And I think that always tends to kind of work best for everybody, especially in that long run, like I said.
Is it much of a collaboration between like you and the band or the manager on like who those producers would be or who would do the video and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is my approach, but you know, other A&Rs have different approaches with this. But my approach has always been, how can I add value? You know, like what do you need me to bring to the table? It's less about me coming in and saying, right, cool, I filled the table with loads of stuff, pick what you want. It's more about like, cool, okay, what is it you need from me and how can I help? So if a band comes to me and they're like, we're set, we've got our producer, we know what sound we want, we're working in this studio, and unless I have like a fundamental objection to what they're presenting, I'm like, great, cool. You know, that works for me, is that you've got a really clear vision about how you want this record to sound and who you want to work on it. And, you know, that's super important. But equally, it's like, I'd love to open my black book and say like, okay, all right, cool. Who do you want me to call? You know, like, is there somebody that you've always wanted to work with? And like, if I already have a relationship with them, happy to ask, you know, what's your schedule like? I've bought this new band in, would you be interested in working with it? And I will then have suggestions about like, cool, maybe think about this, or, you know, think about that. And that, it, as I say, it's probably 50-50 in terms of kind of how that happens, in my own experience anyway. But yeah, you know, it's always fun, you know, putting together a kind of team, especially a production team around a record, and working with the band to that's ultimately what you're trying to do. You're trying to help the band deliver on their own vision for what record they want to create and how they want it to sound, how they want it to look. And it's your job to just aid and assist with that.
So, I mean, with Back to the Advances, what sort of stage does a band need to be at before they can be looking at the advances and being like, we want to be able to live off this and not have to do day jobs?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a bit of a myth, you know. For me, it's, I'm working with bands that are at a really, what I would consider a really high level in some cases, and those bands still have some kind of other job, and it's sometimes quite surprising. I don't think people realize, you know, sometimes there's touring bands out there that are like, they're either working in, you know, other music companies, or they're working at studios, or they're working at, you know, any kind of job that's kind of on their downtime to kind of make up what they're doing. But they have it so that it's a flexible, you know, scenario. So, you know, a good example of that would be, I don't work with this band, but I've known them a long time, is a band called Tesseract. So James from Tesseract, I actually formed a PR company with him like 2010, I think it was. But he's still working at that company, but he's just been on a 6-week tour, you know, played the last show last night in Dublin. But whilst he's on tour, he's doing PR, and he's working, and he's got clients, and he's, you know, doing other stuff. So yeah, I mean, of course there are some bands out there that are making a living from it, but it's difficult when there's, you know, unless you've got, well, say, especially when you've got members of the band that all have like an equal right or an equal share.
Yeah.
If you've got like 4 or 5, sometimes even 6 people in that band, you're then sharing whatever the you know, the income is between all those people. And, you know, the reality is that sometimes that's difficult to live off. You know, it's not always the case. Of course, bands at a, you know, a very high level are earning enough to make it work. But you just tend to find that people have got like, they've got other hustles going on, you know? Like, I know so many people in bands that have got a clothing company, or that have got like a hot sauce brand.
Yeah.
Or like, do you know, they've got like just other stuff going on. You know, maybe they're all, some are promoting shows, some are doing, you know, like other bits and bobs that are just, but I think the important thing for those people in those cases is just having that scenario which gives them that balance, where it's like, they know they're committed to being a musician, they're committed to being in a band, but they also want to have this kind of flexible other side that can kind of fit in alongside that. So yeah, so I always try to kind of debunk that myth, because I think it's, you know, I would encourage every band ever to try to get to a point where they can live off of it for sure, 100%. Yeah. And I always trying to help a band to get to that point, but it can take time for sure.
So how did you personally get into A&R? How did that start?
So I guess I've been working in the industry now about 20 years. I started my own record label in about, yeah, it was the end of 2004, 2005. So I was promoting shows at my local uni, at my local venue. There were some really, really cool local bands that were kind of coming through at that point. I had some contacts through, you know, kind of the day-to-day of what I was doing. And I kind of realized that like, there was an opportunity there, that there was, there weren't many kind of grassroots indie, like independent record labels kind of coming through that were representing the music that I was seeing and the music that I've, you know, been into my whole life. So I started a record label.
Was that Basic?
Yeah, Basic Records. Yeah. And we started, yeah, just kind of early on, you know, we released, like Enda Shikari's first single, you know, we signed, local bands like Fell Silent, who went on to form, Monuments, Tesseract, Heart of a Coward, you know, those kind of bands. Signed Bury Tomorrow, like really early on, did their first album. And then, yeah, just kind of things you know, developed from there, really. But my, I guess my passion has always been working with musicians and working with, especially with songwriters. You know, I do write, I have written in the past, and I'm always super buzzed to kind of work with other people that are creating music and creating songs. But to combine that with, I guess back in the day was like a kind of an entrepreneurial spirit where I was just like, I think I can combine these two things. And ultimately that is fundamentally what A&R is. It's having that kind of left brain, right brain thing where you're like, okay, cool, we're going to take this, but we're also going to commercialize it. And it's, yeah. So that for me, it was like just a burning passion to kind of, you know, to get into it. And yeah, and things just grew, you know, from there. And, you know, I put a lot of work in, and as I said, you know, we formed a PR company around the label in 2010. So that was, you know, 5 years later. Had a publishing company that kind of sat in around that as well. And yeah, it's been a fun time. It's been hard work, and it's cost a lot of money, but yeah, but it's been good fun.
You obviously had some really, really good bands signed to that.
I mean, yeah.
What was the sort of goal? Was it to grow the label with them, or was it to grow the bands so they could be picked up by a bigger label? And
yeah, a bit of both, really. I think, you know, you kind of need to understand when you're running a at that time a really small business, you need to be aware of your position in the market. You know, I'm at that time I couldn't compete with, like, you know, massive labels like the one I work for now even. And so you kind of need to just be a bit more scrappy, a bit more kind of, you know, you actually have to work twice as hard to kind of get in front of everything. But for me, it was about, yeah, just like finding new things, taking some bets, but just trusting my gut and my instinct on like what I think is interesting, what I think, you know, like a public in our space, music lovers, music listeners in our space want to hear. And not only what they want to hear now, but what I think they might want to hear in the future. Because, you know, again, that's the thing for me, like, it's just really important to kind of find those things that could be interesting. I guess the most obvious example of that for me was Sleep Token. So, you know, I signed Sleep Token in like 2016, and, you know, that was super, super early days. We did that second EP in 2017, I think. But that was, again, just like that whole kind of development phase of trying to find something interesting, trying to find something new that wasn't the fully formed thing that you see now. Every band and every artist is on that kind of development journey, and, you know, whatever, it's very rough around the edges, but the concept was there. The talent was there, you know, the music and the vision for kind of how to deliver that music was all there. It was just about kind of, yeah, picking it up and developing it and trying to kind of amplify, as I said earlier. So
what sort of deal did you do when you signed Sleep Token? Was that a full record deal? Was it a license? Or?
Yeah, no, it was just a license at that time. So, you know, my deals back when I was, you know, kind of doing that was super flexible. You know, for me, it was just kind of helping to kind of give the artists enough of what they need to get this thing moving, and then, you know, kind of put some weight behind it, promote it, you know, we're paying for PR and radio and, you know, all of those kind of things. But in terms of, like, you know, kind of like big tied down deals, that's never really been my style, and certainly not when I was running my own company and my own label. So yeah, so it's kind of, you know,
so does that mean there was no back catalog for you to?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, that's kind of the thing with licensing is that, like, you are essentially, you're exploiting it for a limited period of time. And, you know, I think it depends on your viewpoint on that, but I think the industry as a whole has kind of switched a little more to more of a licensing landscape. And I kind of think that's great because it's, you know, it's super artist friendly. You know, there's like tons of stories, not just in our world, but like in the music industry in general, where, you know, even Taylor Swift, like, re-recording her own records because those previous records belong to Universal, which is fine. Universal spent a lot of money on Taylor Swift in the early days, and so you kind of understand it from a business perspective. But obviously, as an artist, you know, as that artist grows, it's like, yeah, I kind of want to own my own records now. So yeah, so that's where licensing kind of comes into play, where it's like, you invest in it for a certain time. The exploitation period of that deal gives you a certain amount of runway to be able to recoup and make that money back, make that investment back. And then, yeah, hopefully at the end of that period, everyone's made money and you're like, shake hands and you're done.
Could you just touch in on that then with, like, someone like Taylor Swift? re-recording. Could you explain like why she would need to do that and why she's allowed to do that if Universal already own the recordings?
Yeah, so what you tend to find is that in most recording contracts that you would usually have a re-recording restriction. So what that means is that you're not allowed to re-record those compositions in a studio environment to then re-release or release at a future date. I don't know the specifics of that deal, but my assumption is that re-recording restriction, essentially that lapsed and it timed out. And so she was free at that point to say, okay, well, the original masters, the original sound recordings, they will always belong to Universal. But she now has gone through that period where she can like, okay, cool. Well, I can go back in the studio, record Taylor's version and Taylor's version or whatever. So I think that's what it was called. I'm not a massive Swiftie, so I don't know for sure. But yeah, but so that's why. And I mean, I'm, you know, even with licensing deals, you know, the ones that typically are out in the world, you know, even the ones that we do will have re-recording restrictions. Because I mean, essentially what we don't want is we don't want to kind of, you know, dump a whole load of investment into a band to promote a record. And then all of a sudden they just like, they go re-record their own version a year later and then start promoting that. And then like, what we're like, well, guys, we had a deal and we invested in this record and, you know, and whatever. So it's just about, it's kind of about fairness. And yeah, I guess depending on which side of the table you're at, it depends, you know, that then depends on like how long that re-recording restriction term might be.
So, I mean, with the rights that the label's buying, can you sort of just explain the difference between the right that label has and what effectively the publishing is?
Yeah, so publishing is very different. So the label is only really ever concerned with the sound recording, and that's, you know, the thing that you hear, essentially. Publishing is essentially the underlying composition. So if you were to look at that song as a piece of sheet music, that's the composition.
It's like the intellectual property that is the song, not the
physical product. Yeah, that's the song itself, not the sound recording. So the way to think about it is that for anything, like, you know, you bring up Spotify, listen to your favorite artist and listen to your favorite song. Within that song, you've got the thing you're hearing, that's on one side, and then split that out with who's written that song, and the composition of the arrangement and everything else. And that on the other side is where the publishing would lie. And the reason that those, well, not the only reason, but like a big reason why those might want to be split out is because essentially you might have a sound recording that somebody's written but didn't perform on. You know, you could have someone that's written the lyrics, for instance, but that person that wrote the lyrics actually isn't in the band, but they're a songwriter for that. So they would be credited on the publishing side as a songwriter and as the lyricist, but actually they're not a performer on the sound recording. So it's a good way of kind of splitting that out. I've got to be honest, like most of the stuff that's in our space, you tend to find that the songwriter is also the performer.
Yeah.
You know, the people in the band are the people writing the songs. So yeah, so it's kind of uncommon, but it, you know, it does happen. There's plenty of, you know, ghostwriters and producers and, you know, some people involved in songs that you would never realize. But yeah, it's always fun. I always love looking at the label copy and the credits and they're like, oh, who's that? They're not in the band. Like, how did that happen? So yeah, it's always good fun.
Awesome. I mean, you mentioned working with Sharptone. How did you get involved with those and why have they been able to grow so quickly?
Yeah, I guess, so to carry, I guess just the final part in the story from my own career. So I guess around 2017, 2018, I was invited to join quite a big music company, independent music company called Believe. At that time, Believe was going through an acquisition of Nuclear Blast Records. And with my background, obviously, what I'd been doing for the last, you know, kind of 15 years or so, that was an interesting opportunity for me to kind of transition into the Nuclear Blast business. So I did that around, that must have been probably 2020, I guess. I was at Believe for a couple of years, but then joined Nuclear Blast Sharptone officially in 2020. Prior to that, Sharptone was started by my colleague Sean Keith, and he started the label brand under the Nuclear Blast umbrella. And that was probably, I think, 2015, maybe 2016. So that's always been a part of Nuclear Blast and came over to Believe and the wider group as part of that acquisition by Believe of Nuclear Blast and Sharptone. So it's a little bit of a kind of convoluted situation in terms of how it happened. But then ultimately, through my work at Nuclear Blast, you know, I've known Sean for a long time. In fact, we worked together back in 2006, where Sean's label, so Sean used to be at Sumerian Records, and he licensed Fell Silent record from me when I was at Basic for a North American release. So I've known him since that time. So we got this kind of cool opportunity to work together. And, you know, Sharptone's been very much his thing that he's built up, you know, over the last few years. And I've had the opportunity to kind of assist him with that since 2020, around that kind of time. So it's a good mix for me on a personal level. You know, both label brands kind of represent slightly different things in terms of their offering in the market.
Yeah.
But you know, ultimately, you know, for me, it's just between those two label brands, it kind of covers off pretty much everything I love about heavy music. So it's a real kind of joy and privilege to be able to, you know, sign things, bring new bands in, you know, and develop that stuff alongside Sean and the rest of our team.
Awesome. So, I mean, you just mentioned doing a North American license.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? How does that work? Like, why would a label want that?
Yeah, it's also not just the label that might want that, but the artist might want that as well. So it's about practicality. Sometimes it's about that kind of, you know, reality of kind of where you're at. I think going back to 2006, the label I formed and I ran is a small independent label, and we didn't have an office in North America. We didn't have any real kind of impact in North America. Sumerian was still a small label then as well, but those guys were based in California. They were doing, you know, at that time, quite similar thing to what we were doing over here in the UK and Europe. And, you know, we were working with a band that they thought was interesting and could be interesting for a North American audience. So they reached out and we worked out a deal because we had worldwide rights for the record. So we sublicensed that that record to Sumerian for a North American release. So they did press their own CDs, you know, they released it on Spotify, Apple, and, you know, all the rest of it, and kind of marketed it as a North American release to their audience. So yeah, so to do a license deal is really just, sometimes it can be a really good way of expanding your reach, both as a band and, you know, for a particular record, but also for you as a label. You know, you might be developing that artist, but you might want to work with a partner that has a really good grip of what you do in their territory. So yeah, so it can be a good option. I must admit, I kind of do that less and less now where I'm at now. And the only reason for that really is because we have great international offices, you know, like Sharptone and NB has, you know, people in LA, Nashville, New York, Paris, Hamburg, Stuttgart, Melbourne. But, you know, like there's people kind of in most key markets. You're kind of like, okay, we've got boots on the ground there. We've got a good operation. We don't necessarily need to license stuff out in those markets. But, you know, it still does happen from time to time. And usually in places like Russia or South America, China, Japan, you know, that kind of stuff. Again, because those are quite specific markets. There's still markets that are interested in the music we release, but we don't really know that market
someone that lives there and specializes and lives the music in that.
Exactly. Area. Yeah. So that's when we would license out to a partner there.
Awesome. I know that one of the bands you signed was Malevolence.
Yep.
How did sort of that go and how did that come about?
I guess, yeah, we've been in touch with those guys for a while. I was in touch with Charlie, the drummer from the band, for quite a bit. You know, those guys are so great at running their own business, being self-sufficient, doing their own thing their own way, and usually not compromising on that, which I absolutely love as you know, kind of part of their DNA. They had their own, you know, kind of label setup. They still do. You know, they have a cool little collective of bands that they work really closely with as well. And I think they'd kind of just got to that point where we did an EP that was through our, we have like a pure digital distribution brand called Blood Blast. And it is what it says. It's just digital distribution. You know, there's kind of nothing really, anything else on top, but it's a cool system that's part of Believe, this bigger music company that specializes in what we do, that's like super light touch, is just digital distribution. And they did their EP, I think, through that. As we kind of suggested that, because I think they were looking to kind of expand who they were working with and whatever. So we kind of did that. That works really, really well. And then they got to a point where, again, they were just like, they knew they needed to grow and they needed to kind of work and you know, start to engage with other partners, international partners. You know, they brought on new management, they brought on new booking agent. And another thing they wanted to do was potentially bring in a new label that had that kind of international impact and international reach that could really help them kind of grow to the next stage. So they kind of came about, you know, through that. And again, that was just a, you know, negotiation with their new management at the time.
It being 5B.
Was 5B, yeah, from your neck of the woods. So.
Yep.
And again, we work with those guys on a whole bunch of different bands, you know, have a great relationship, really good understanding about, you know, kind of what management is bringing to the table and what they need from a label and, you know, and everything else. So yes, it was just a really good, really good partnership. So we did that, you know, the latest album, Malicious Intent, and it's gone really well. So awesome. They've definitely, you know, they're definitely on a good path and are growing really well.
Yeah. I mean, they're going upwards like violently, like yeah. they're rising. They, separately to Uproar, we have a charity called the Uproar Mental Health Foundation.
Yeah.
And we started getting bands to sign drum skins and we stick them on eBay and we use that to pay for counselors.
Awesome.
And they were the very first band to sign a drum skin. And it's still the most, like we put them on eBay and that got the most out of every band that we've done.
Amazing.
So like, and we even had like Bring Me sign them and stuff like that. And Malevolence are actually the,
wow.
Like their fans just fucking.
Yeah.
Die hard.
So. Same as the band. Like, you know, they're just solid. We were talking earlier about real ones. Like they're just solid, solid guys, you know, real people doing it for the right reasons. And yeah, I just love them. They're great.
So when you work in, not specifically with them, but with a band of that level,
yeah,
what sort of are you then looking at in terms of contracts and lengths of the period and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously those are, I have to speak in kind of general terms. You know, this is, I can't speak about somebody else's business terms on a podcast, which I'm sure you understand. But it's the same approach as anything, really. It's about just understanding what the band needs, you know, what their expectations are in terms of, you know, kind of how they would like things to work. And then it's my job to find a solution for that. And, you know, hopefully it's something that can work for everybody. And in Malevolence's case, it was. So yeah, so there's a lot of that kind of, as I said before, kind of massaging where you're just like, okay, they're at this level. This is what they need in terms of support from a bigger, you know, from a label or, you know, or any partner, to be honest. And then just trying to put together something that we think, well, okay, this is where we think the band could go. This is the ultimately you're talking about revenue, because it's like if you're giving something out, you need to be bringing something in, you know, that's gonna offset that and pay for that. So yeah, so trying to put together something that isn't like completely picking numbers out of the air. It needs to be realistic. And yeah, just trying to come to some kind of agreement about, you know, like what they need versus what we think they're, you know, their growth could look like, and what their revenue could look like.
Is this sort of like a general, like how many albums you'd like to sign them? Not necessarily them, but like when you're looking at a band, are you looking at it thinking, well, we need three albums or we need four albums or?
Yeah, not necessarily. I think the, like, you know, those kind of firm album deals, they're quite old school. They're quite major label in some cases. You know, we're still, you know, we're a big company, but we're still independent. We have a lot of flexibility in terms of the types of deals that we offer. And we're, as I said, you know, certain parts of our business, we're just doing straight digital distribution deals via Blood Blast. And then other things we're doing like full label services deals, you know, via NB or Sharptone or whatever. There's not really like a kind of set amount of albums that we would say like, it has to be this. Not for us anyway. All we're trying to do is that if we really believe in a band, we're trying to make sure that we are at some point protecting our investment. You know, I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's like, okay, cool. Like we are willing to get behind the band. We are willing to invest in that. But of course, you know, there needs to be an understanding and a realization of like, well, we're here to run a business. we're all here to run a business.
Yeah.
And that needs to be kind of factored in. So that tends to be why you would see, like, you know, if there's a really high level of investment at the start, you'll tend to find that there will be like more options built into that deal, or, you know, slightly bigger restrictions, or, you know, slightly different royalty rates or whatever. The whole thing kind of has to come out in the wash depending on what your license term is or your exploitation term, because, you know, ultimately if you don't have enough runway to make that money back, you lose. So yeah, so you have, one way or another, the deal has to make sense depending on the level of investment that you're making.
I mean, on that point of having to make the money back, with your label Basic, when you were doing those deals, did you get to a point where you were looking at that thinking, actually, I want to keep these bands?
Yeah.
You, using Sleep Token as the example, if you'd managed to sign them for a record deal and keep the back catalogue, that would have been
worth quite
a bit. Like, what was the decision where you were like, that isn't what I want to...
I guess it's more just to kind of, sometimes it's a decision, but sometimes it's also understanding, you know, kind of where, what your leverage was when, you know, when you were doing it, when you're in the negotiation period. You know, the stuff that I was doing with, you know, with Basic is, as I said, just super flexible, super artist friendly. You know, for me, it was important. The thing is that I didn't have a lot of overhead in my business. You know, we had literally a handful of people. You know, we were paying for office space, but it was like shared office space. And so it's not the kind of overhead that like a company that I work for now has. So in terms of what we needed to do and the types of deals that we could have were probably slightly different, just because that's kind of how the business was made up. Yeah, it's just kind of one of those things. Sometimes it's a decision. And even when we get to the end of, you know, license periods with certain bands, we'll renegotiate. We'll say, you know, like, we would love for this to continue for another few years. And sometimes if we're at the end of that exploitation period, we'll give them a further advance on the next 5 years if we want to extend it by 5 years or, you know, whatever. So it's always a conversation. You know, of course, sometimes there's things that you're just like, this didn't work out, you know, like no one made any money here. You know, it just didn't work out. And that's the nature of the business. You're not going to win everything. The trick is to just try to make sure you win more than you lose.
Yeah, that's fair. That's us every single week with the Club Nights.
Yeah. I mean, anyone that's out there doing it, you know how this works. Putting on shows, putting on Club Nights, releasing records. Like, it's all the same thing. You're like, sometimes this will work and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're like, man, why didn't this work? We did everything right. We promoted in the same way, we booked the same way, we did, you know, like whatever. Sometimes there isn't an explanation even for it, but yeah, that's the business we're in.
Yeah, I mean, with the bands, if you have signed them earlier, as an A&R guy, what's your role then with the band? Like, do you continue with them as part of their career, or do you just sign them and then they move on? Or
yeah, I mean, as long as they are with me and the company I work for, I'm always involved. But as I said before, I'm not there to be overbearing. I'm not there to tell them what to do. I'm there to amplify what they're already doing. I'm there to give advice if they want it. And really, the way I kind of see it is more to kind of help with the rudder, you know, like help to steer them in the right direction. If I can see that they're slightly off course, it's just making a little adjustment to be like, all right, cool. Like, we're just a bit off course at the moment. We need to make this change and then we can get back on track for where we need to be. And that's kind of, yeah, my role once we're done and we're in and we're moving and all of that, you know, all of the business stuff is all taken care of. That's really my kind of ongoing role. And my role within my company is to essentially run the vision for what the artist wants to do through every department in the company to say, this is the vision, this is what we need to achieve, these are the targets, and then to give it to our, like, you know, project management team and our digital marketing team. And, you know, and the press team and whatever, to be like, okay, cool. Like, this is the project. This is what we've discussed. These are the ambitions, targets. Cool. You guys, those guys are the ones that execute on the vision. I need to help. I need to be the one that kind of brings it to the table and delivers it as a project for them to execute.
Does it happen often where you've signed a band and then what they want changes, or the direction they want to take changes, and that doesn't align them with what you thought you were signing or with what the label wants?
That's a great question. And yeah, it does happen sometimes. It's rare. And that's why I said before, it's really important for me, especially with new stuff where you're like, you know, there's a dating period. where you're just like, you're just trying to kind of get to know and just trying to understand a little bit more about what the long-term vision is. I was in a great meeting the other day with a band that sent me their debut album. Incredible record. Love the sound of it. They came in for a meeting. And during that meeting, they were talking to me about songs they'd written for album 3. And I'm like, great. Like, that's exactly what I want to hear. And it's just really interesting because that just tells me that I'm like, all right, cool. Like, this isn't something where they're just like, well, let's do this and see how it goes. They're like, no. Like, we're in this for the long term. And, you know, it's important to us. Like, this debut record, like, we've had this and we've done it and we've recorded it and everything sounds great. But we're like, we've already written a whole bunch of stuff for album 2. We've written a few more things which we don't think will go on album 2 because it's a slightly different, you know, approach. We want to leave that for album 3. And for me, that is music to my ears, literally, where I'm just like, okay, great. This is something that, you know, instantly, if we were to move forward with this band, the investment that you're making in it is that the probability shifts in terms of like, is if they're going to just be one and done. And, you know, or whether they're going to be a career band that wants to kind of consistently come back to keep doing it. So, yeah, so it's like little things like that where you're just trying to like calculate risk at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if they've got a vision for that far future and they're planning like that, then you know that they've got their shit together and they're a much more solid investment.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's important. You know, I'm not here to all of my time and energy and invest my company's money into something or people that are just like, hey, we're just here for fun. And, you know, like, if it doesn't work out, then like, oh, well, who cares? You know, it's like, there are too many other artists that will be artists. I'm looking for lifers.
Yeah.
I'm looking for like, when these people are 50, they'll still be writing music. They'll still be, you know, doing what they're doing because something within them compels them to do it. You know, like those are the kind of people I want to work with.
As the A&R guy then, when you sign a band, if that band does well, does that reflect on you? Like, do you get bonuses or is there other incentives? Like,
yeah, I mean, there can be. And again, that's not always the case. You know, sometimes if you own your own company, as I did, you know, back with Basic, and you are the A&R, of course, you know, when the band does well and you do well, that then benefits you as the owner of the company. But I was also the A&R of the company as well. I mean, in that instance, of course, it works out. I know that at other companies, you know, people are paid a salary and they're there to just, maybe they're just there to scout. Sometimes there can be kind of, you know, things like finder's fees for scouts where it can be like, well, there might be a percentage on the deal if it gets signed, you know, as a scout, they might earn a commission on that.
Would that be likely if you were employed directly by them?
Yeah, it can be. As I say, it's not, there's not really a hard and fast rule. It just depends on the company and their particular setup. But of course, yeah, you know, in some A&R setups, there are bonus structures for sure.
I mean, one of the other things that we know you set up then was the PR company, Hold Tight.
Yeah, Hold Tight PR, yeah.
So what was the goal of that and how come you didn't just go with an existing PR company?
I think just serendipity, really, when I look back on it. I actually did need to hire out PR. PR is not my strength, you know, by any stretch. I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. What happened was is actually the guy I mentioned earlier, so this has come full circle, James, who's in Tesseract. I met him because obviously the guy, Ackle from Fell Silent, we had this project called Tesseract. He was looking for new people to form a band, what would become the live version of Tesseract. And James was one of those people. So I met James through that process. And he worked in corporate PR at the time. I knew that he was just like, he desperately wanted to do music full time, whatever it was, playing in bands, doing other stuff, you know, whatever. So he already had PR experience. Between him and I, we had a shared kind of, as I said before, an entrepreneurial spirit. I employed James to run press for Basic. And that's really kind of how it started. And so he did that for a while. But what happened was is that we ended up being really, really well connected in our space. And other bands that were outside of what we were working with at the label were asking us to do PR for their bands or for their label. And so we saw an opportunity at that point. And yeah, 2010, we formed Hold Tight PR. And that was really to run PR for Basic Records, but also so that we had a vehicle in which to do PR for other people as well. And yeah, I remained a part of that company until 2018, and I left then to join Believe. But that company still goes from strength to strength, you know, whole number of staff there. I'm not involved with it anymore, as I say, since 2018. But I'm in regular contact with the guys, and they still do great work.
What would be the goal that you'd be looking for when you take up PR for a band? What is it specifically that you would be like, okay, they've nailed their PR campaign? Or what would it be where you're like, they fell short?
Yeah, I mean, from as I say, I'm not a PR. It's not my area of expertise. But what I can say is that from an A&R's perspective, and from, you know, delivering or hiring a PR, it's all about this amplification. As I said before, I'm looking for somebody that understands the vision of what this band is trying to achieve, that understands the music and where to place it. And ultimately, the reason you're hiring a PR is because you're hiring them and their network, their contact book, essentially. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to use their expertise to seed this band that you're working on with the right people, to get the right people talking about it. And that could be anything. That could be like things on podcasts. It could be influencers on social media. It could be like a whole bunch of stuff, you know, whether it's like national press or radio or, you know, online blogs or, you know, whatever. It could be a whole bunch of stuff, but that's ultimately what you're trying. And in terms of results, it really depends on the objectives that you're setting from the beginning. You might have a band that just wants national press coverage. You might have a band that actually just is more interested in seeding what they're doing with influencers or whatever. So it's on a case by case basis.
Would that determine whether you used in-house PR or outside PR?
Yeah, sometimes it can do. You know, in-house PR, sometimes there is a more kind of a generalized approach because you kind of need to cover a lot of bases when you're doing that. But as I say, if there's something specific that you're going for, there might be an agency out there that actually, you know, like really specializes in, I don't know, say you want to connect this band that is like rooted in sci-fi. There might be like a PR agency out there that covers a whole bunch of that stuff that could be interesting for crossover. And they might be seeding it with like Astronomers Monthly or I don't know. Is that kind of stuff that like a normal, like, you know, regular label PR might not have. So it depends on the objectives, but yeah. And similarly, going back to like different markets, if we know the band is like big in Japan or Australia, and we actually want to have like a more specific attention to detail in that market, then we would probably hire a publicist in that market who has those connections and that natural network.
Is that something that would be sort of negotiated at the start, or would that be something where the band's already got its deal, you've already agreed the advances and what the label spend is going to be, but then you see it working in a particular territory and you're like, shit, we need to run with that?
Yeah, it can be both. So, you know, sometimes, depending on where a band is at in their career, you know, sometimes we'll pick up bands that are, you know, five albums in or more, and they've got a team, you know, they've got a PR person that they've worked with from day one, and it's important to them that they retain them through the campaign, and that's fine. You know, like from our perspective, you know, unless there's again, like a fundamental reason why it would be a problem, we hire external PRs all the time based on the fact that they have the relationship with the band, they know the band and they're trusted and can get the job done. That's fine. That's all good. So sometimes that can be from the start, but other times it can be ad hoc where you're just like, actually, you know, they've just done this tour, but they toured after we signed the deal. They've just started popping off in this particular market. Yes, maybe we need to look for radio plugging because they've got a commercial track that's like, and then we'll hire a plugger ad hoc, or we'll hire a publicist ad hoc, or, you know, whatever. So it can be on a case by case basis.
The last band really for me to bring up is Zetra.
Okay.
Because obviously you've recently signed those. Mm-hmm. We, I think, have signed them now. We've definitely started the process of signing their publishing for Pro Publishing.
Yep.
How did you find them? How did that come about?
Again, you know, a good A&R has an impeccable network. was recommended to me, and it was actually one of the guys in our office. It was a couple of the guys actually that I think they, do you know what? I think it was here. I think it was at the Black Heart where they'd seen them open for some band or, you know, whatever. And I think there was just this air of like intrigue that was just like, what was that? You know, I didn't really fully kind of get what it was, or but there was something. So it was like, okay. And so I just thought, you know, I need to look into this. And I'd kind of heard it from like one or two other people. No one really knows the band yet, you know, like, and that's fine. But this is what I was saying earlier about like going into something for the long haul. You know, I didn't sign Zetra because I think, you know, like they're going to be the biggest band in 12 months. I 100% truly believe in their talent, in their vision for what they want to deliver as artists and what they want to achieve.
Yeah.
But I know that it's going to take a period of time. So I'll be honest with you. I actually signed the band ages ago. What I wanted to do is that I wanted to make sure that they had time to develop and to kind of form a little bit more about like who they are, what it is they're trying to do. And also to really hone in on the songwriting. Like we've been going backwards and forwards in the studio with like revision after revision after revision of like, I mean, they probably had close to 20 songs, you know, that we were considering for what will be their debut album.
Yeah.
And you know, that like that album still isn't announced yet. You know, we've just been kind of, we've dropped a couple of singles, but I signed them ages ago, like maybe 2 years ago.
Oh, I did not realize
that. Yeah. So, but that for me, again, that's important for me. It's just like, we've only just announced it, but I'm not one of these people that just like, you know, if we know we've got the right thing and we really truly back it, give it the right environment, give it the right setup, the right resource to be able to really make sure that when you do deliver it, it has that impact and it has that longevity. I've seen so many bands that have had like instant industry hype and then 12 months later, it's gone.
Yeah.
And I do not want that for Zetra. They're worth more than that, you know, in terms of their talent. But yeah, I think, you know, that's a real good example of taking something on a super early stage that is not fully formed, but just understanding who those people are as artists, who they are as musicians and as songwriters, and really coming to terms with like, okay, these guys are 100% in this to take it as far as they possibly can. The thing I need is that when I throw stuff at bands and I'm like, you know, we need to do this, we need to do it, how about this, how about that, these guys are like, yep, cool, bring it on, more, come on, is that all you've got, keep going, you know, like stuff like that. So I, you know, I'm like, okay, I think we should reach out to, you know, Phil Vallow, for instance, and be like, talk, you know, send some new tracks about this band where Zetra is now his favorite band and he's taking them on tour all around Europe.
Yeah, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. But again, it's about like getting the right people involved. You know, Will from Creeper, you know, listened to the band. These guys are great. Invited them to open their show at the Roundhouse. Love the show. Now they're doing a tour together. And it's those kind of little things where you're just, for me, it's about that kind of slow build and just kind of putting them in front of the right people and, you know, not trying to force the issue too hard. You know, that's important too. So yeah, it's super, super early days with Zetra. But, you know, I mean, as long as I'm working with them, I'm going to be working my ass off to try to, you know, I want them to be the biggest band in the world.
I mean, they're the perfect example of a band where other bands just love them.
That's true.
Like, yeah. It seems, I mean, I only get little bits passed back when, I don't think I'm supposed to say the names are. So when one of the band members, when we chat, but it seems that like a lot of the stuff that they're offered just comes from other bands thinking they're amazing.
Yeah.
Is that common within the bands that do well, or is it?
It can be, but for me, that's just an indicative thing of knowing that you've got something unique, you know, for them, you know, not for me. And I think that's why they're resonating with people, because there's nothing out there that sounds like them. There's nothing out there that looks like them. Well, there is, but it's in black metal world.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think, but you know, but everybody wants to, you know, see something refreshing. You know, look, we all love metalcore, or we all love pop punk, or we all love death metal, or, you know, whatever. That's all great. And, you know, long may those genres reign. But it's, yeah, I think it's always interesting when someone comes along with something that's like, oh, that's a bit different. And, you know, that's how I felt about Sleep Token back in the day. You know, they were like, yeah, it's, I kind of want to do this thing. It's like a Sam Smith vocal, but with Meshuggah. And I'm like, what? You know, and I was like, I can't, that doesn't make any sense. And then when I heard the demos, and then when I heard like, oh, okay, hang on, wow, I can hear a Meshuggah riff underneath this Sam Smith vocal, and it, and somehow it works. It's like, okay, right, this is super interesting. And I, yeah, as I said, I felt the same way, you know, totally different musical style, of course, but I felt the same way about, you know, Zetra's approach in terms of what they were doing. They were recording everything on like a 4-track recorder, and, you know, like it was crazy. Like these things I was hearing, and I was just like, this is wild. It's just like a, you know, an old like drum machine and a tape deck and you know, and live guitar and vocal over the top. But there's something really interesting happening here. So yeah, that's always exciting when you can, you know, when you can find those things. And I think that's what other bands are kind of latching onto. It's like, you know, yeah, I love these guys because they're real. They're genuine. They're amazing songwriters, nice people to boot, which helps, you know, they're good guys. But yeah, I just think that's the thing that's connecting.
Awesome, man. Thank you for your time on this. I think we've just about done. Is there anything you wanted to promote or?
No, I try not to self-promote too much. I think we've talked a bunch about, you know, stuff that we're working on. But I guess if there's like another kind of on the, you know, that Zetra is on the Nuclear Blast side, maybe another UK thing that's happening on the Sharp Tone side is a band called Unpeople. So look out for Unpeople.
Awesome. Definitely have a look for those and encourage everyone else to. Thank you for everyone that's listened. If you want to watch us, we're available on YouTube. Please follow, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you.